Welcome to the Chameleons Podcast. In this episode, we meet Dr. Beata Sarah Haynes, a clinical psychologist and renowned executive coach, tech investor, and entrepreneur, and CEO of Coachera, a coaching and SaaS platform that combines multidisciplinary expertise with several training and educational tools for upskill training and development. Beata is committed to coaching individuals and teams towards maximizing their human potential and has been called the real-life Wendy Rhodes, the character from the TV show Billions. Her list of collaboration is long, including collaborations with top tech founders, C-suite executives, Fortune top 20 CEOs, professional athletes, investors, and stakeholders. In this interview, we cover a lot of topics: her journey and career path, the importance of immigrant resourcefulness, her entrepreneurship and work at Coachera, and how they work on integrating diverse skills and work-life balance for the individual growth, organizational development, and change management, navigation of company culture, burnout in Silicon Valley, and the navigation of humility and self-promotion, as well as the importance of defining one's core values. This interview reminded me of what it's all about, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Before we start, just a quick mention of a new sponsor. Nomono is a Norwegian company dedicated to improving and simplifying podcasting. Their portable sound capsule is easy and intuitive to use. You simply put on their Wi-Fi connected multi-track recorder, use the 4 high-quality wireless mics to record, and it gets automatically uploaded to your very own Nomono Cloud, where the AI-powered audio enhancement provides exceptional audio quality. Check out their website on nomono.co. I highly recommend it. This is the Chameleons Podcast, and I'm your host, Imak Zambrana. And now, the interview with Dr. Beata Sarah Haynes.
I'm really, really excited to have you as a guest on this podcast, Beata. You're my new hero, and I can't wait to talk to you about your work and your story.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Mac. I really appreciate it. I think we all have a hero inside of us. So I appreciate that acknowledgement, but taking the time that you have to be able to get to know me is really appreciated. And I look forward to share my experiences and knowledge, and with the hopes of being able to help reduce human suffering as much as possible, and to really help motivate and hopefully inspire individuals to find their own inner heroes. I'm not special in any way in that light. I'm honored to be able to get to know people at a more intimate level in my work as executive coach and a licensed clinical psychologist, to have the trust to really get to know people's stories and the adversity they've gone through and the challenges, to be able to be quote unquote successful from the outer world criteria, as it were. But I look forward to digging deeper on the human factor and resilience and grit that I celebrate every day in my work.
Yes, I love that. You have this really broad but also very specific goal of reducing human suffering and burnout. You have really decided to contribute to building human capacities and creating communities that will support that goal. And we'll get to your work soon. But before we start, perhaps you could introduce yourself first, your background. So how did you end up being interested in building professional growth, personal growth, and maximizing both of those aspects of human development?
Thank you for that. I guess I can rewind a little bit in terms of my own upbringing and my cross-cultural background and my ability to be able to take perspectives as a result of being a child of war and revolution. Overnight, our life changed with the Islamic Revolution coming into Iran. Overnight, the rights of women were taken away. And my parents were educators, and my father was an executive in radio and television, and they sacrificed their own safety for others' safety. And part of that story is really about my parents' decision that, being the only daughter, I have two siblings, one's older, one's younger. They were concerned largely for my safety and my ability to really reach my potential in that kind of an environment as a woman. And so they decided that they would risk everything for my ability to have the opportunities in the United States. Why it was interesting that it was United States was that we were actually here in the United States before the revolution. My father was getting his master's, and we went back, and 6 months later, the revolution started. So we came back to Washington, D.C., where I was in elementary school at the time, and was privileged to be able to be in the capital of the United States, where every language was spoken and heard, and cross-cultural representation was the norm. And growing up in Silver Spring and being exposed to Washington, D.C. culture and Smithsonian's and Howard University and HBCUs, and that becoming a part of a normal life has really shaped who I am. And when there isn't diversity and there isn't representation, that's where I realize where my comfort zone is and discomfort when I see companies and organizations, largely in tech and also in academia, a lot of the tenured professors were male. And I remember walking into my first psychology course at University of Maryland, where there was a woman that was the professor, just moved from UCLA, and she was on the tenure track. And this young, vibrant, blonde hair, blue eyed woman was our professor. And then I took another course where my mentor was Dr. Janet Helms, who was the only African-American woman who was tenured professor who taught women's psychology and also cross-cultural psychology. And she was the godmother of cross-cultural psychology. And she took me under her wings, and I did research with her. She wrote my letters of recommendation. She poured through applications for graduate school for me, because my parents were immigrants. They really didn't know how to help navigate that whole world of graduate school. And so, just rewinding back, that I've been really fortunate to have really incredible women in my life that have been role models, including my own aunt, my grandfather, sending my mom and her sisters abroad. They went to Europe, to Paris, to study at the Sorbonne, and they worked at the Pasteur Institute doing cancer research. And so I would go into their labs and inject and do research on the mice that they were working on. So very early on, my role models were women who valued education and helping others and reduce suffering through their work. So I think that's been the archetype for me growing up. And so I was supposed to actually be, I was a pre-dental student. And I told my father, as a result of my mentorship, that I wanted to become a psychologist instead. I wanted to be able to get to know my clients and have a more intimate relationship with them instead of having instruments in their mouth and people not wanting to see me and being numb when they leave and drooling and not being able to really have that positive experience or positive relationships with patients. So he told me basically that I was working an undergrad. At one point, I had three jobs. I was an NIH fellow, ERTA fellow, which exposes women and underrepresented to the sciences. So I was at the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, exposed to international scientists. And that came from one of my clients when I was doing nails. My mom had a nail salon. When we came here, she had to do entrepreneurship and work in hotels. And my dad had to drive taxi cabs, from having maids and chauffeurs to going back to doing different kind of levels of work, which was always the role model for me, was being of service regardless of statute. But my dad basically told me, I was also waiting on tables, and he said, all the things you're doing right now, if you don't finish, you get your master's or doctorate, you'll be waiting on tables for the rest of your life. With a bachelor's in psychology. So I said, okay, I'm going to get my PhD. And that was my rebellion in some ways to prove to him or promise to him and my mom that I would finish my PhD. So I applied right from undergrad to graduate school and because of my mentors at NIH, really encouraging me to say the master's and doctorate level work is actually a lot easier than undergrad, where you're really focused on the things you're passionate about and you're in your flow zone and you can spend hours studying and learning things that you really want instead of all these other courses that may never be relevant to your subject. So anyhow, I applied straight from undergrad to graduate school. I got accepted to two programs, one in South Florida, which is a PhD program, and then the other one was a master's program at Pepperdine, which is a terminal degree. And I decided, with my mentor's advice, to get my PhD, go to that program. And I got my master's within a year and a half afterwards. Wow. So I started at 23 graduate school. By 24, I had my master's, and then by 29 I had my PhD, and by 30 I was married and had children. And so I did everything as a very impatient immigrant, because time is not promised. I have this urgency inside of me that anything can change in a moment when you go through a revolution, that everything's temporary, good and bad. And so there's this urgency to achieve and to be able to share my knowledge. I became a tenured professor. I did my fellowship at Georgetown Medical School. Most of my training has been in the medical school model, which is what I brought to the business world, which is very unique, a multidisciplinary approach that I brought. And people really didn't understand what I was doing as a clinical psychologist in a venture capital firm. And I would have to keep explaining. I was a researcher at Georgetown. I do diligence on health tech and ed tech, which are my subject matter expertise. And I applied my research experience to investment and to human factor and cultures within companies. So as a cross-cultural psychologist, I brought all of those kinds of underpinnings of psychology and the importance of cultural representation and company culture on optimizing performance, which an ROI on every business is how do you optimize for resources, for time, and for profit as well.
So you started with health tech as a tenured professor. So you had the clinical psychology as a foundation, and then the health part and tech. How were you introduced to that?
So the common thread in my career has always been this idea of the impatience, first of all, which I see a lot in a lot of the people I work with have this sense of impatience for time and wanting to do things quickly, and which is important in tech as well, but also the importance of impact. When I first started my specialty training, I've decided that I wanted to become a clinical psychologist, because basically as a clinical psychologist, I could have the optionality to set up my own practice. I could become a professor. I could do research. I could consult. So I had as many opportunities as possible, like the highest level of ranking, I guess, in our field, where you can do research as a PhD and you can do clinical work, and you have flexibility to be able to adapt to whatever your environment and needs are. As you grow, you can continue to evolve your own kind of career. I did that. And also I wanted to specialize with women and children, because I felt from my experiences of going through wars that many times children don't have a voice and women don't have a voice. So I wanted to become an advocate for women and children. And if I had the training for children, then I could always work with adults as well. It's always about optionality and being able to have as much options on the table, and that no one could ever close the door to me, and that no one could take away my education and my knowledge and my experience as something that was a value for my parents and my grandfather and grandparents, who were very progressive about education and women having access to education. So that's part of my value system that I was raised with, but also I became frustrated. As you'll see, frustration is a mother of innovation and change and trying to find a solution. Working with children, I felt like an ambulance chaser, waiting for children to get harmed and traumatized. And then I was going to come and put on my cape and be a hero and save the day. That was great. And I felt really wonderful to be able to help people initially, and children, be a voice for them, navigate the system, forensic psychology, and collecting evidence for children who've been traumatized. But as soon as I became pregnant with my son, my professional wall just crumbled. I realized I can't just wait for children to get harmed. And I felt like an ambulance chaser waiting for that to happen. And I dedicated my life to prevention at that point. And I said, this is not the way I want to live. I want to be able to prevent as much as I can in my life so people don't have to suffer. So I looked for opportunities that would be in prevention and applied for postdoctoral fellowship at Georgetown and the OBGYN department with pregnant moms before the children were born, so that I could still advocate for the moms, work with the moms to educate them so they don't become targets of abusive individuals who are looking for single moms in situations to be able to prey on their children, and also for reproductive health, for nutrition, breastfeeding. We worked on postpartum depression, domestic violence prevention. Wow. So my training has been around behavioral change and being able to help educate folks to change behavior in the medical school arena and wellness related health promotion. And so I was responsible for 5 different hospitals in Washington, D.C. at the NIH grant, Howard University Hospital, Georgetown, Washington Hospital Center, GW, George Washington Hospital, Columbia Hospital for Women, which is now a condo. They converted a hospital for women into a condo in DC, which is telling about where our priorities are, but also working with African American women and Latinos to reduce infant mortality was the main focus. And that is something that I'm very passionate about, is understanding how to navigate disparities in healthcare. And Serena Williams, someone that famous, is being ignored when she was having her health issues during pregnancy. Imagine the woman that doesn't really have power or influence as much as Serena did, for example. So that's been one of my many hats that I wear, literally and figuratively. The passion for being a voice for others and to help be a conduit, and to be able to bring all of the culmination of my background into the business world. In the academic world, things move very slowly. You have to apply for grants, and it takes a long time to be able to get financial resources. I was invited to be on the applied clinical research track at Georgetown, which is a huge, huge honor. And that was at age 33. And so I stayed on until even after 9/11. And then I decided to teach more in the academic world. I became a tenured professor at St. Petersburg College, and then did a lot of advocacy for students with disabilities and military students, wounded warriors that have trauma and have learning differences, people who have basically what we call invisible or hidden disabilities, things that you wouldn't necessarily if you look at someone to know that they are this challenge. And so I've worked a lot with the faculty building civility campaigns when people weren't able to speak about politics at the time. It was a different election year, similar to what we're going through today, being able to have civil conversations and using critical thinking without emotions was the campaigns that I started, and risk assessment on campuses to be able to prevent active shooters. So the thread again is always about prevention and have a plan in place for active shooters on the campuses where I was. So I helped build that. So I've always been an entrepreneur since sixth grade. I had my own little candy business.
Is that true?
That's a whole other story. Of
I love that.
My parents are immigrants. So if I wanted Calvin Klein jeans, or at the time it was Jordache jeans or Guess jeans, I couldn't ask my parents for $50 for a pair of jeans. And so I've worked since I was 13. I've had my own little newspaper route with my siblings that I would go out in the snow and the rain to throw the newspaper on the porches early in the morning and the weekends, and to have some pocket money. And then I realized that kids really liked candy and chewing gum. I did a product market fit. And I would go to the drugstore and buy like a pack of gum, Bubblicious, and sell one piece at a time. It was 25 cents then. And I sold it for 10 cents a piece. And there's like 5 pieces in there. So I doubled the margins there. And then I would buy the 5 pack, which then reduced the cost and the margins. And then my dad saw how like entrepreneurial I was, and he took me to Washington, D.C. to this warehouse district where it was just for business owners to buy big bulk candy and gum. It was a really shady kind of area. It was really scary, but I would go in there and like, I don't know how we even got into there without a business license. But anyhow, yeah, that's another story, I guess, for immigrant resourcefulness. So I got the big bags of candy, and then I had this whole business going on until the school decided to shut it down because I was cutting into their kind of profits in their little store that they had. So instead of encouraging entrepreneurship, they had me do detention and I got in trouble. Yeah.
I love that your father still supported it and saw the initiative and really understood that this is a good business model.
For sure. So I saw my mom having her own salon and nails, doing nails, and I helped her out with the business and I would manage all the employees. I would drive them. I would buy their products and negotiate contracts. So this was all in undergrad. I feel like as immigrants, and that's one way that we can really make our own future and destiny. When people might close doors for you, that you can build your own sort of business. And that's why we actually gave an endowed chair gift to Howard University in my dad's name, since he went to Howard for a PhD in entrepreneurship and finance at the School of Business. We gave a $3 million gift in his name, the Dr. Abraham Bishop, our endowed chair position, because no matter what happens in government decisions, entrepreneurship is one way that people could really have a sense of destiny and empowerment to make their own kind of generational wealth. So that's another value into the business world. To answer your question, was I got frustrated with the academic kind of politics fight over things that are really inconsequential because it doesn't really matter, right? And there's all these major like things happening in the world and they're fighting over little egos and names and things like that to have limited power. And the speed in which by the time we apply for NIH grants, get the money, hold up and set up these five hospital research protocols, by the time we actually collect the data, then disseminate that data, hope to get published, that information is already outdated, unfortunately. So the cycle of academic world is not really conducive to speed. And so I look to see where there's speed, where there's resources, where there's smart people and innovation, and all the arrows pointed to Silicon Valley. And that's where I got recruited to due diligence in a venture capital firm for health tech and ed tech. I was chief of staff at a venture capital firm. They had $650 million under our management. We invested early in Uber, Airbnb, Rent the Runway, TaskRabbit. So a lot of companies that have IPO'd, PillPack that Amazon purchased. And so I've had the privilege of being in the rooms where decisions were being made and realizing that the founders have and require so much support, where I was a community psychologist and researcher, I was helping people who were disenfranchised. I realized that many times, because people are outwardly successful or innovative or smart, people assume that they don't need support and they don't have stress and they don't have burnout, they don't have mental health challenges. And it's harder to ask for support in some ways when people are expecting you to be able to perform at such a high level, and to sustain that level of performance is really challenging. And so when we made investments into companies like Uber and Airbnb, I had front row seats to see all of the different cultural factors, of the different stresses of hypergrowth companies, and the unfortunate lessons learned about company culture and quote unquote soft skills are the things that really I de-risk from the work I do as an executive coach, is helping avoid burnout, helping sustain that level of optimized performance. Because in Silicon Valley, things are like on steroids. They move so fast. Washington, D.C., things move fast. And Silicon Valley is on a 24-hour cycle. So there's a lot of burnout and people don't stay. I call it dog years in Silicon Valley. Like the number of years, just multiply that in dog years when you're in a startup, because it's really working around the clock. And it's not sustainable unless you know how to integrate your personal and professional life. And that's where I brought the methodology I developed in my classroom and perfected it for the boardrooms. And I did retreats in Silicon Valley and Sonoma and Napa and Carmel, where we would set our own goals, and called it the Dream Keeper Retreat, to keep our dreams alive. Because we're not even on the back burner. I joke, and we're like, I'm not even close to a heating element sometimes, because we're so focused on helping other people and nurturing other people's goals that we forget about being intentional about setting our own goals. And so that's the added value that I brought into the technology world. And a lot of people initially were like, what is a clinical psychologist doing in a venture capital firm? How did you get here? It was so unconventional. And until like the show Billions came out, where Wendy Rose was a psychiatrist that worked in hedge fund dealing with optimizing performance, people were like, oh my God, have you seen the show? You're the real life Wendy Rose. So people started comparing me to Wendy Rose. And I was like, okay, I don't have time to watch television, but let me see this thing because so many people have said it. I should watch it. So now I joke, like people compare me to the real life Wendy Rhodes, minus the S&M and the things that, and Axl Rhodes, like evil kind of behaviors, or, but you know, a lot of the things that I've seen and I can help with is really optimizing company performance and company culture. And we started an incubator here to show that Silicon Valley is a concept, not a location. So in our incubator, we started Bolt Mobility with Usain Bolt. And I was a co-founder, and one of the investors kept pushing me, like, don't you want to be the co-CEO? I'm like, no, I didn't really ever think about that. Here, I'm always in the back of the house and as a chief of staff, making sure everything's running smoothly in operations and investment relations and dealing with sovereigns and different cultural factors there as well, came in really handy. And she kept pushing it. And so finally, I said, if that's the best, she said, you're in the best position to know company culture, and you've been hiring everyone. And we actually ended up winning the number one startup in Miami for company culture and places to work in 2020, before the pandemic. And so I'm very proud of the company that we built. We launched in Paris and we launched in Japan and built our teams in UK and Germany and Italy. So as a cross-cultural psychologist, it came in really handy to be able to navigate cultures in Japan, working with the top businessmen. And I was really scared in many ways that I would be discounted as a woman in Japan, especially, or in the Middle East and Dubai. I was doing conferences there at JITEC and so forth, and we're dealing with investors and sovereigns in Saudi. And to my surprise, I was actually respected and deferred to much more than my co-CEO was a male. And they kept saying, Dr. Haynes, Dr. Haynes, Professor Haynes, when they would refer to me. And I realized, oh my goodness, being a professor and a PhD is the highest echelon in most cultures around the world, except for the United States.
In Europe.
They actually respected me so much more because of that, despite being a woman. And so a lot of my own kind of expectation or biases of what I thought would happen in Japan was actually surprisingly and pleasantly surprised by the reception that I had working with individuals from Samsung and a lot of the big heads of companies and Tokyo University and so forth, and our partners there.
It's amazing that you were able to open up several branches and sites in different cultures. You could probably talk a little bit about how you work and what the company provides of assistance to people. And I guess there's so much work to be done in order to translate that when you're opening up all these sites across cultures.
We had an amazing team that was very dedicated to having clean energy and really believed in the impact that we were making. Unfortunately, regulatory issues were not, you know, ripe for electric scooters yet. So sometimes we'd find our scooters in the Seine and having to find magnetic fishing rods, figuring out how to get our hardware out of the river Seine. And when you do anything new and innovative, people are not necessarily ready to have the behavior that is required to follow the rules and be good citizens around that. So it takes time anytime you do something new. But what, a lot of the things that I learned in doing business in Europe, especially, we laugh as Americans, like we work nonstop, and trying to take a few days off is like a big deal, especially in the startup world. Imagine like wanting to take off all of August or something like that, or bank holidays. Sometimes the team wanted to take off bank holidays. And I'm like, wait, we're not a bank. First of all, we're a startup and we have to work when people are off. And that's when they use our scooters. So there's a lot of setting expectations in a way that challenge the norms in Paris, especially with the team. And because in some ways we have a lot to learn from that model, that they really don't live to work, they work to live. This was really important to realize from an economic powerhouse model of like the United States, where we think about work-life balance is a very different idea. And I think millennials and Gen Zs are starting to really realize the impact of working those kinds of hours and demanding more work-life balance, which as a Gen Xer, we didn't have. And we're kind of like, we didn't get that memo. And so we've all been burned out. I don't know anyone who is listening to this that hasn't experienced burnout as a result of being a high achiever, working hard, trying to prove yourself, especially as a woman or underrepresented and outsider. We have to work 10 times harder. So we're more likely to become burned out because we're working 10 times harder to show and prove that we belong at the table and we don't make mistakes. So we have to like work double the time to make sure that we deliver. And so we're more likely to have these kinds of experiences. And so navigating the different cultures, navigating and adapting to new norms is really why I built Coachera, because I realized this is the culmination of everything I've done over almost 30 years of my career. I can't believe that. As I said, I started very young, so my 20s. But I think ultimately what I've learned in my experience is that the people that adapt, the people that are able to adjust, and companies that are able to be resilient and to be able to be nimble and adapt to market conditions are the ones that survive, right? And that's ultimately the survival of the fittest also includes mental fitness and the idea of being able to take care of your mental health, to be able to know and carve out work-life integration is how I call it. And the five pillars that Coachera was built on is based on science. My supervisor is Dr. Nathan Asrin, who only wanted evidence-based work in my clinical work and my dissertation. He was my dissertation chair as well. And he was a Harvard-trained clinical psychologist who was trained by B.F. Skinner. So everything that we did was data-based and measurable and evidence-based. You couldn't just say, I'm doing this because it feels right or it's intuitive, which there's value in that. But when we really get down to results, we need to have measurable milestones. We need to be able to show to our shareholders that what we're doing and the money that we're spending is going for being able to optimize performance. And so the platform I developed is a software platform. It's a SaaS platform and it's a marketplace so that you can have access to experts, not just life coaches that are 20 something and all of a sudden anyone can become a coach. And so there's a lot of noise in the coaching world. And so I wanted to differentiate Coachera as a place where you can come to, where you can find vetted professionals that are multidisciplinary and multicultural. And that's came from my experience of working in multidisciplinary teams in the medical school, because you can come up with solutions much faster when you have a different perspective and lenses on a problem. And you can come up with a lot better solutions when you have different perspectives and avoid groupthink, which is a really big problem in companies where everyone looks the same, everyone has the same backgrounds. And so the research shows when you have multicultural teams, multidisciplinary teams, you actually perform better. And the bottom line and the ROI is much higher in companies where there's more diversity, not just for diversity's sake, but being able to have intentional recruiting of excellence, not doing a favor by hiring a woman, but hiring a woman because she's excellent and you want her perspective, because our lived experience is very different. Not all women have the same experience either. Not all Black women or Black men have the same experience. So having one person hired for DEI lead is a huge disservice in some ways, because they have to represent this whole group of people. And as a cross-cultural psychologist, I say that a lot when I look at investments. I want to see teams that have different ages, different genders, different disciplines represented, because that's really a stronger fit. So sometimes I'll see an all-women team, which is fantastic. I'm proud of that. But I put a question mark to that as well, because you want to have some representation as well from all sides to have a different perspective. That's also something to consider. So I think ultimately the human factor is why I built Coachera, so that you can set up your goals based on milestones, based on behavioral principles and cognitive behavioral principles, to first really dive into what your values are, what's important to you and what you want to prioritize as your core non-negotiable values. What your values are in your 20s or when you're teen, when you're 30s and 40s, shift a little bit in terms of priorities. And so it's okay to say, I'm similar to my family upbringing based on this, but I want to do things a little differently. I want to reprioritize what's important to me and what I value, because the more we can reduce the delta between our values and our behaviors and have alignment, then you have less burnout, less psychological conflict, less psychological stress. Anytime you have a conflict with someone, it's because of a disconnect between values and behaviors. And so it's either somebody mistreated you based on your values and what you expected in their behaviors, or you may have behaved differently than what you value. And so that disconnect is really where the answer is in terms of reducing burnout, reducing psychological conflict, so then you can optimize performance. Then you can really put your head down on the pillow knowing that you are living by your values, and you can make faster decisions as a result, because now you have this lens of your values, not in the back of your mind. Because when I ask people, what are your top five values? They haven't really spent the time to identify them. What are they today? Not who you were as a teenager, not what your parents necessarily taught you, which is important. But as we evolve and have our own families and our own kind of ideas, we want to be able to reprioritize and shift things for that season in our life. So I use a lot of person stages, Maslow's hierarchy. A lot of the work I've done is based on those theories that are proven in the research. And so I'm bringing that to the business world, ultimately to help managers who are also burned out and overwhelmed with distributed workforce and the future of work to know, what are the things that are important to our teams? What were they struggling with? What kind of feedback do they need? Millennials need a different level of feedback, and managers don't always have the time to give them feedback. So this platform allows you to have asynchronous communication between managers and employees on these five different pillars of financial and leadership, career goals, leadership and personal evolution, health and wellness, family and intimate relationships, and community network. So when we set goals and KPIs, it's not just the professional goals, which is important for your annual performance reviews, but also, what are your personal goals? What are your health and wellness goals, so that you can sustain your health and be able to hit those sprints and hit those goals that seem unsurmountable at sometimes, and being able to build on your strengths rather than the medical model, which is mostly focused on disease and what's wrong with people.
So when you have a company, for instance, as a client, would they then have access to the solution online for all their employees, and they're all integrating that solution into their work schedules and setup?
There's five pillars, right? Mm-hmm. Two out of the five pillars are business related. So the first two are financial and career goals and leadership and personal evolution. The other ones are health and wellness, family and intimate relationships, and community network. Those three things, if they're not right, if there's anything that goes wrong with their health and their family, as you can't really focus and optimize for your work. So it's important to give a nod to our personal KPIs and professional goals here as to find greater balance. And you can choose to share your financial and career goals with your, you know, financial advisor, with your boss, if you feel like you want to share your career goals. What is my career trajectory here? What are my options, and how do people get promoted? What's the company culture around? What are my KPIs to get recognized for my work? Because especially as women underrepresented, we've been taught to be humble and put your head down and do your work and people will recognize you. And unfortunately, we don't have the kind of touch point anymore for people to really see how hard you're working or going out of your way to help people in your team. So we really need different ways of being able to measure that. And that's why I built Coachera, so that you can share your wins and you're hitting your milestones and your goals with your boss or your supervisor or your immediate report. And if you're having setbacks, you can also send them the same email from the app and the platform to say, these are my setbacks. I'm wondering if you have any solutions or things that I can do to help solve for it. I need extra support to be successful. So it gives a mechanism of communication that's asynchronous, because so many managers don't have the time to really have one-on-ones with every single person every week. And so this solves a problem for that process. And I don't know any manager or employee who enjoys doing performance reviews. It's a checkbox that's done, and it's really not as productive and doesn't allow for coachability and coaching people up, because you're missing the quarterly kind of reviews. And Coachera provides the quarterly goals and weekly updates. If the individual wants to document those on the platform, they can share that with their partner at work as well as partner at home. If they have goals around even date night, how important that keeping those things are sacred in a relationship. Many people are having children now, so because of the pandemic, they are not delaying those things that historically we've delayed for our career. So employers have to start to recognize that you have high performers that are adjusting their values around what's important to them. And how do we give them the grace to be able to have loyalty for us to give them that space to honor their priorities while honoring their personal priorities and their professional priorities.
I love the fact that you have a really clear idea and communication of values for yourself, but also for others. And so that just made me think, I know what my values are, but I seldom actually think about them in connection to the work, because you're dragged into the work and you have this project or you have this ambition and you go all in and you try to solve it. And those values are there in the back. And when something happens, you might touch on them and really, oh, remind you. But a lot of the time, they're not there up front in the consciousness as a navigational assistant in a way. So that's really amazing. Are those values very varied? Do we people have a lot of diversity in those primary values that we have that are guiding us, or do they actually often overlap in essence?
It's a great question. The goal is really with the exercises that we do is, first of all, it's asynchronous. So people can do it on their own or they can do it with a coach. And we have an AI component that also helps you be able to navigate and ask questions for additional query so that more people can afford to be able to have access to the platform. And so to answer your question, I think it's so important when you are looking at your behaviors and your values to recognize what's the light at the end of the tunnel. What's your reason why you're working so hard, right? Sometimes you have to make sacrifices because you have children in college and that your values are not always aligned with the work that you're doing. And that is also temporary. Everything, as I said, as the philosophy that I have and the philosophy of the people that I've worked with that are resilient is that they have that adaptive mindset that this is temporary, that once I have this goal met, which is my education for my children, a much higher priority for me right now than my personal value for making impact. Let's say, I'm just giving an example. But once my children are off to college, from college, then I can really focus on making impact, for example. Then the reorganization of impact can happen. But the ideal thing is to be able to find work that also makes impact so that when you're at work, you're aligned, that you're not selling your values for something in exchange that you have to then change later on. So as we make decisions, if ideally you can find a job that is also aligned or part of your job, let's say you work in a hospital setting or you work in a business that is doing good, focusing on that part rather than the politics. And I said academic, there's a lot of politics. I can focus on the politics or I can focus on my students, right? And the impact I was making on my students and the relationships I still have today with my students from 10, 20 years ago, they still stay in touch with me, right? So I think that living a life well lived is really important, of the relationships that we have that are not just transactional, but also building these kinds of community relationships that are win-wins, and looking at people who are just extract value instead of adding value. You start seeing these kind of patterns develop in human behavior, and you can choose to be able to bring people in your life or work in your life that is aligned with your values, so that you are basically having this compounding effect where things become a lot easier because you've chosen a job that's aligned with your values, a partner that's aligned with your values, your health and the way you spend your time with movement and activities that's aligned with your values, and in community. So we do walk and talks here on Wednesdays. I sponsor coffee or tea, and we walk in front of the bay. So we get the early morning sun in our eyes. That's important for circadian rhythm and emotional motivation. So we use a lot of behavioral science and neuroscience in the work that I do. But also, guess what? In that 1 hour, you're building community. You're coming together. It's in here in Brickell. And we meet at the Starbucks at the Bond condo at 7 o'clock. And I purchase the coffee for everyone that is following our community. And then we walk and we have this community where we set our goals for the week. And then we keep each other accountable week after week when people come back. So in 1 hour, you're integrating your health, you're walking, you're getting early morning sunlight, you're going to get your coffee or tea anyway. Now you're building community. So the more you can say yes to things that hit more than one of the five pillars, the more compounding effect you have and the more you're optimizing for your time that's aligned with your values.
Wow. I love how that just takes that box that you mentioned earlier, like impatience and urgency, like that kind of getting the most out of the time as well. Not compromising, but really getting all of those boxes ticked.
Exactly.
Have you ever thought about that? Like sometimes a sense of urgency can be looked upon as negative, like you're impatient. Mm-hmm. I find urgency in that kind of behavior, and I really recognize it myself. It really resonates with me. What you said about academia, you feel like the pace is not working for you always and the cycle. And then that underlying urgency that I guess has always been there since day one, since I was a kid. When you said that you can tick all those boxes in a meeting, I guess we often fall into those patterns where we separate them. Yeah. So we take care of our health after work in the morning, like a stress situation to get it in, get time for it. And then you hurry up to your office. You have one meeting with one person and then another meeting with three more people. And then you try to get that coffee in after or lunch. We divide all of these very crucial events of the day that you can't really compromise on. You need them all. I'm going to start walking with my assistants.
It's a powerful thing. We did it in Silicon Valley a lot. We did walk and talks. And psychologically also is really important because as you're moving, even if you can't be physically in the same place, you're in a distributed environment. If everyone has a headset and is walking and talking at the same time, it allows for better solutions to come up in your brain, because your brain is basically the corpus callosum is connecting the right side of the brain to the left side of the brain. And so when you have movement, you have creative kind of solutions that come up from the right side and the analytical, logical side on the left side. And so there's a lot more solutions that might be innovative or that you would have never thought about except for in that kind of environment. And also, if you have another thing that I always talk about is if you want to have a difficult conversation, instead of sitting eyeball to eyeball in person in a meeting or office or even in Zoom, if it's possible at all to have a shoulder to shoulder conversation where you're walking and talking, it changes the psychology of the combative nature of being face to face and ready to go to war, rather than when you do the walk and talk, you're not having that eye contact. You're able to have your facial expressions without someone like trying to read into it. But it also gives you the ability to find better solutions for difficult conversations when it's shoulder to shoulder conversations. Or I had the best conversations with my sons when I was driving them to soccer or different activities because we weren't eyeball to eyeball. And so they could have difficult, sensitive conversations to the back of my head rather than face to face. It's a lot easier psychologically to have conversations that are not face to face like that.
I never thought about that. The difficult conversation part, of course, a lot of good conversation at least are in the car, are in when you're walking outside, even if you're not walking together and you're talking on the phone. Intuitively, I experienced that and done that, but never taken that choice based on evidence and very solid objective facts of what you're saying, the reading of communication, the confrontational positioning of the bodies. So all of that, it's, oh, wow.
There's so much we know about the brain. I mean, so much we don't know about the brain still. And there's so much to learn from human interactions. And I think one thing, if I can go back to the cross-cultural aspects of values, you mentioned something earlier, it's that when we talk about values, it has to be operationally defined what that value looks like for me to know that I'm congruent with that value. Meaning, if I asked you if respect is an important value to you, right? Most people would say, yes, respect is important, right? But respect in the Japanese culture is a very different operationalized behavior than respect in the United States, right? In terms of even giving your business card, right? Holding it two hands and bowing and showing deference and respect rather than throwing it at them or just handing it without eye contact or what have you, right? Knowing these nuances really help connect people on a respectful kind of platform that's equally respected, because you've taken the effort to understand how to operationally define what respect means in their culture. Which brings me to this idea of golden rule versus platinum rule that I talk about. Most people know about the golden rule. The golden rule is treat others the way that you want to be treated, right? But the platinum rule is even higher level, right? Platinum is more valuable than gold, right? So platinum rule, most people haven't heard of. Have you heard of it? I just want to make
never,
sure.
I haven't heard, so I can't wait.
I always ask because I don't want to assume that people don't know something, but it's a really important concept. The platinum rule says treat others the way they want to be treated versus the way you want to be treated, right? Which then brings in the cultural context of what are the behaviors that they are expecting. So in Japanese cultures, take off your shoes before you walk into the door. Many cultures, like, they don't want shoes in their house, right? That's part of the cultural norm. In the United States, if you take off your shoes, that people might think you're being too informal, or how long are you gonna stay? Or why are you taking off your shoes? Don't get too comfortable. So context, right? The same behavior in a different environment is seen as disrespectful or too informal, right? So it's really important for us to also do our research about different cultures, not to expect them to teach us, because I'm working with African American cultures, working with Native American cultures in New Mexico. I can't go in there and go, okay, I want to learn, tell me what I need to do. If you've been on the receiving side of that, you keep having to educate people over and over again about your culture. It almost is, it's disrespectful in some ways that you could do a little bit of research before you come into the in relationship to hopefully know something about that relationship. Shows that you've taken the time to do your research and understand what it means.
Just to kind of get the, not only the perspective taking, but also the background knowledge beforehand, as much as you can be really interested in that perspective deeply.
That's right. And it's hard, because it's not always do we know if the mission statement of a company or really is, or the values and the vision that they have. And so checking in is also important. Like, are these things important to you, right? And I talk about the love languages when I talk about this as well, which is people see as a different concept, but to me I connect the dots in the same way, because my love language might be very different than my husband's love language because of the way he was raised in his family and how love was expressed, either words of affirmation or touch or gifts or acts of service or time, right? Quality time. So knowing what the other person needs are and how they value the different kinds of behaviors that represent the concept of love, the concept of respect, the concept of integrity, right? People think, oh, integrity is integrity. But if you're in an environment where you have to do things to survive, and for example, the military, right? I've worked with a lot of veterans. It's really hard to have the integrity of human life to be respected, but then you're also expected to go and protect yourself and your country and potentially harm others, right? And so that causes a lot of trauma. And there's a disconnect between our values and behavior sometimes, and we have to compartmentalize things to be able to survive those situations and to be able to make sense of it. Like in that role, that was what was expected for you to survive to come home, you know? And so a lot of my work is really understanding people who've worked in corporate America that have been burned out, is that's the culture that they were in. And that was expected. But, you know, can you behave the same way at home if you're a CEO at work in a corporate environment? It may or may not work with your relationship at home, right? So those are kinds of things that we talk about. It's how not to code switch in terms of having to change your persona and your values, but understand that in this setting, it requires a different level of connection in a positive way, not having to discount your own sense of culture and sense of who you are to fit in necessarily.
Wow. Yes. So really having a deep understanding of those values and how they translate in different situations with different people, but you're still loyal to that value,
right?
And take care of that, because that's really connected with that alignment and having that balance.
That's right.
Yes.
I want to share one more example, if I may, just personally also, I think as a parent, I think as a mom or dad, whoever's listening, sometimes how we were parented and what our parents did for us or didn't do for us shaped who we are. And so a lot of times we think about, like, because I'm an immigrant, my parents worked two jobs. They couldn't come when I played. I was a varsity volleyball player in ninth grade, is a big deal. They only came to one game and it was at the end, and they missed the whole thing because my dad was working. My mom never came to any of my games because she was working two jobs. And so seeing that, and I played volleyball and soccer and basketball, so they had opportunity at every season to come
every
to,
day,
and they just couldn't. But see these parents that would come to not only home games but the away games, and it was like, my God, don't you have a job? Like, how do you not how are you able to do all these things, right? And so now, as a parent who has a little bit more, I guess, agency and power to be able to tell my supervisor, or when I was working for others, to say this is important, now that I have my own business, I can say, schedule my clients around when my children have their activities and to be aligned with the things that are important to me. But even so, my son said something the other day that we're always at work. He didn't come to like some events for me, or I had to navigate something by myself. And I'm like, my parents didn't help me with SAT. They didn't help me with college tours. We've gone to all these college tours with him. But my reaction as a parent is my own kind of archetype of like thinking, oh, wow, like my archetype of what my parents were able to do, what I'm able to do is so much more. But he's probably comparing me still to some other parents who are much more involved, right? And so it doesn't matter if I think I'm doing a great job. He's not feeling that I was as involved, right, as I could have been. And so perspective is important. So my immediate reaction is to defend that, you know, I'm a professional mom, and I'm hoping that by seeing that your mom's educated and professional, and I still made it to your character development, and I volunteered in your school, and I went to all the field trips, and I made it to all of your games, like, that was important to me, right? Because I didn't have that. And sometimes it's important to know what's important to them, right? And try to articulate that. And we can't be perfect as parents. We can't be there all the time and with every little thing, but it's important to also level set, to remind them all the things you have done, because sometimes people forget. And that also is important in the work environment. And sometimes people forget all the things that you are doing in the shadows. If you don't speak about it, and if you're humble about it, and you're like, oh, they don't know I'm doing X, Y, or Z. I'm a big proponent of putting everything down on your calendar that you're doing and you're working on. And at the every quarter, writing down how many meetings you've had and how many wins you've had and how many, like, having data is gold, because then, yeah, it's unemotional. When you go into your negotiation for your raise, you're not asking for something that you're not bringing value. You can't argue with data. You can't argue that you had these many meetings. It's on your calendar. Like, you're not making it up. And so how many meetings you've had? I've had people put it into a beautiful like a diagram and like with percentages, and it's floored their manager because they didn't even realize how many events and activations and how much money they've saved the company. Keeping track of those things is really important so that you can really remind people of your value that you're adding professionally and sometimes personally also with your children or your partners. It's not to say like I took the trash out 10 times or whatever, but being able to remind people of the sacrifices you're making to make that relationship a priority is important, because sometimes people don't even know all the things you're dealing with that you're setting aside and having to manage and balance to be there for the family outing or whatever it is that is important to the family or the work environment or your parenting kind of role as well.
I remember we talked once and you said something about humbleness and about being a quarterback in life or something. I just remember that picture, women multitasking, trying to navigate all of these tasks of being a professional, being a mom, being involved in communities, creating communities, taking care of. And in addition, when you go into leadership, in addition to all of that, and just navigating all of that, yeah. And how a lot of the time, at least I recognize that myself, I'm really socialized to be humble. And that can also be a Norwegian cultural thing. Like we have this social law that's called the law of Jante, which we laugh of a lot, but it translates to you're not supposed to think you're better than anyone. It's a very socialist, get back in line, like we're all equal kind of principle. But a lot of time, I guess that translate into just doing all of your tasks silently, just balance it, figure it out, but you don't brag about it. So a lot of time when I go to the US and someone asks you about something, and I went to the summit recently, and they were having these circles and you're supposed to go inside the circle every time you had done something. If you're writing a book, or are you a scientist? Are you a professor? Do you have a startup? They asked all these things. And I realized like, oh gosh, I had done everything except for one thing. And I was like, I had to go into the circle every time. And I felt like, oh gosh, I feel like I'm bragging.
Yeah.
You know, this feels really uncomfortable. I don't know if that's the case with women in the US, but I feel a lot of the time here that I think it's more so for women.
Yeah.
But that feeling of you have to learn how to promote yourself in a humble way.
It's a humble brag, right? You have to like kind of let people know that you're doing the things that are important to you. And I always say, if you align it with your values, like why is it important that you're a professor? Why is it important that you've written a book, right? It's not about the book. It's about the reason, your reason why for writing that book, right? To leave a legacy, to be able to impart knowledge, to be able to have something that lasts, you know, beyond you, right? Or captures your moment in time and history, right? And so I think whenever you go back to negotiating from your values and negotiating from your personal reason, I think it minimizes this boasting or bragging kind of thing, but going back to your reason why. That's important to me. The reason why it was important to me to finish my dissertation. And I didn't even say all the things, the trauma that I went through and during that time to get to finish my dissertation. But it's a privilege to be able to do these things, right? And so if we don't speak about it, it's actually dishonoring the work and the challenge and the opportunities that were given to you to be able to do, or maybe it wasn't given to you, that you've taken the onus and responsibility to make it happen, because then you're minimizing. I used to not say Dr. Haynes. I used to not put PhD in my name, especially in venture capital. And then I was like, it's not really relevant. I'm not in the hospital setting right now. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. And so we use the terms when it's relevant to the setting, so that people know and identify us as the professional that is seeing them, right? So the patient knows who they're dealing with. And so I didn't think it was important. And millennials don't care. The hierarchy is like not important to them. So we had a pretty flat organization also. But as a Gen Xer, also is important as an immigrant, a person said that when you don't say about your degree, you're actually not showing representation for what a woman with a PhD that's an immigrant looks like, right? To have different archetypes in their mind about what's this clinical psychologist doing here. I had to wait for Hollywood to come up with that archetype in Wendy Rhodes, just for people to go, oh, now I
understand. That's what you are.
There's a term for you, or who you are. There, you belong here, right? Until then, yes. I had to explain human behavior and behavioral economics, and investment relationships. Our investments are always about psychology and our psychology with money and FOMO and wanting to get an investment deal and getting your foot an allocation of a deal. And like all the things that are involved in the VC world is all psychology. Like,
yeah,
you can't take that away. But when you look at your podcast about chameleon and being able to adapt to environment, it's so important to know who you're speaking with, what's the environment and the milieu that you're working in, to be able to adapt to it, to be able to survive within those, the context of the expectation. But also, I would challenge us to push the envelope a little bit of what's expected of us, and to be able to show what a woman or underrepresented or male from underserved areas is able to navigate. And for me, it's about celebrating the human factor of, we all have gone through some challenges in life. If you've lived long enough, you've had some adversity or challenge. And that's an important concept that I always, when I interview people, I want to know if they've gone through any adversities where they felt like it was unsurmountable and they didn't know how they were going to ever overcome it or find a solution out of it. And they do, and they realize that they're able and capable of doing anything. So we can build and scaffold, and based on top that strength that they've done it before and that they can do it again. And that's the human sort of condition that I celebrate, is adversity. And I think I interviewed one person one time, bless her heart. She said, I said, what any adversity that it helped you professionally, personally to overcome that you feel comfortable sharing? And she's like, I've never had any adversity. I've lived a really charmed life and it's been really great. And I'm like, oh my God, you're not going to survive a startup world. You've never had any face any adversity. And so in that setting, in a startup world, it's a whack-a-mole. You're just like solving problems every second. You have to prioritize what's important and hopefully don't compromise your values in the midst of that as leaders. And it's challenging, but, you know, the goal is to have this intersection of our culture, our human behavior and performance be able to help us and around community and support, so that we can all be able to really optimize our performance wherever we are and navigate and learn how to adapt and change without giving up our values necessarily and compromising it and finding win-wins throughout that journey.
One thing you mentioned earlier about optionality, maybe the environment is a leading factor for that wider perspective of, or being aware of the need to have that wider perspective of, well, where can I go with this and what can it be used for, this education or particular expertise? Can it go in this lane in the academic world? Could it go into the startup world? So having that, always being aware of optionality of the environment forcing you in a way to thinking wider with regards to what you can apply your skill sets towards. I really recognize that. We never have completely similar backgrounds, but some commonalities is that I grew up with a single mom, a father from Bolivia in Norway. I did martial arts and then football or soccer, and I played a lot. And I think she saw two matches over, I don't know how many years, and my father never saw one. So used to walking there by myself and getting a ride somehow. And the same way that you talked about, always having to figure out how to provide opportunities for myself, for my family and my daughter. It has been a driving factor and has forced me to have a wide net sometimes and really increase the optionalities, I guess, the options I have all the time. And sometimes I wonder if that has, is that a negative thing? So sometimes it feels like, oh, I wish I could just narrow it down and just go down this one lane and really just focus on that. But then the fact that I had to do that for so many years, it feels like I can build upon that in specific situations. It doesn't feel like it was a waste of time. It just feels sometimes that, okay, then I have to apply this in this way here. And that one thing that you thought you never were going to do again can be usable for something. But sometimes it does feel like having a wide net necessarily would prevent you from really narrowing it down to a specific crystallized aim. Yeah.
I think it's our, again, the onus comes back on us to be a storyteller, to be able to identify how our backgrounds apply to the scenario, right? Because most people don't necessarily have the breadth and the depth of knowledge, and they make it up. So it almost, like when you said that you'd be humble in the United States, it's like people make things up that they haven't even done. They have this level of confidence that they say something as if it was factual. And people are like, oh, wow. And like they say, the confidence of a mainstream man, like to be able to have that level of confidence to say, I've done X, Y, or Z, and not think that anyone's going to fact check. It's like, wow, okay. And as women, we minimize many times our actual things that we've done because we've been socialized not to intimidate people, not to become threatening to people, not to be make people feel less smart or less than or what have you. Be nice, play nice. And I'm all about being kind and what have you. That's really important. But to the detriment of our own kind of work and hard work that we put into it, it seems a little bit out of context. But also, when I think about how do we add value, I hire for people who are, especially in the startup phase, that are Swiss Army knives, right? They have multiple tools in their toolbox in one little container. And so I think it's an added value. Like there's things that are not on my resume or not on someone's resume. And I ask that during their interviews, is there something that's not on your resume that you might have not put in there because you didn't think it was relevant? And so you find out things like, oh, I'm a bartender or I'm a DJ. Or, and then I get to find out that they love music and that that's their like passion, right? And how, as a CEO, how do I integrate that into the team? Like if we have an event, would you like to be the DJ instead of me hiring somebody? I can maybe give you a little bonus or something for doing that. Or if we're in a bind and we need to make drinks and a bartender doesn't show up, I know I can lean on you to make some drinks in the back. You don't necessarily want to be in the front of the house making drinks or something because of your professionalism maybe. But at the same time, like you can solve problems that I didn't even know you had these skill sets. So I think sometimes we hide things because it doesn't seem like it fits the environment, or people might have a stereotype of whatever it is that you've done looks like, and they don't expect that. But you know, I celebrate that. And if you're in an environment where people are celebrating those things, then you're in the right place, right? Rather than having to hide something that is actually not something to be embarrassed about, or that's an added value or added strength that sheds light about your musical talents or something to that effect. So I think ultimately, like, when we talk about innovation, we talk about solving problems and adapting. The people who are innovative are able to solve problems that are frustrations that they've had. And I've shed some light into the frustrations I've had in my career and how I pivoted each time towards where I am today is a culmination of everything I've done is built into Coachera, and that other people can benefit from it. And it's an LMS, it's a learning management system. So I brought that from the academic world of teaching and building courses and having people be able to be entrepreneurs and have a turnkey platform as coaches and experts to be able to monetize their knowledge instead of people picking their brain for free. So that's an entrepreneurial skill and perspective that I want to share with others. And so that's there for free for people to utilize. And then I have my methodology that's based on science and research and that hat that I wore in academia and research that I'm sharing now and in the business world and organizations to be able to optimize human performance and be able to see the person and their values as a whole person and holistically helping them with their personal and professional life to integrate those two sides of them to be able to really maintain that optimal performance and sustain it so they don't get burned out because they're optimizing for time.
Yeah.
These are ways I think if we celebrate people's paths and find a way to integrate all the different components and hats you wear, something magical can happen. Like Coachera is something I've built that solves for many problems that people may have in the business world and professionally as well.
just reflecting about what Kuchera is and all the elements of expertise that's integrated in that business. So all of these components and that sense of optionality that you always had to look for, like, how can I optimize my opportunities regardless of where this goes, regardless of the direction this current situation, and then the focus on unlocking potentials and capacities in people and all people facing challenges. I love those threads when you see that coming from your background, coming from the reality that you experienced being you in that context that you grew up and the opportunities that came your way, but also the opportunities that you really created for yourself, and also the urgency, that passion for impact, for making a difference for others, and then that platinum rule of really seeing yourself in others, like not trying to have an egocentrical, altruistic perspective or perspective taking, but actually having a truly altruistic and inclusive perspective taking. So all of these coming together, it's so interesting to see how you came from all of this and have created all of this. And then you end up building this amazing tool and service that can support other people to handle and navigate their growth in a complex, holistic way. Seldom am this blown away about how everything just clicks and comes together in a puzzle.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think and I'm not being humble by saying this, I think the work that I do is actually helping everyone see that there's a thread that runs through their career that all makes sense, that will culminate in something that is a amalgamation of every aspect of who they are, can be poured into something, a project, a book, a passion project, whatever it is, a new platform or entrepreneurial goal that makes you unique, makes you differentiated. There's a lot of coaching, you know, platforms out there. None of them are licensed clinical psychologists. None of them are a tenured professor. None of them are who I am. And so I think that differentiates what Kuchera is from all the noise. But also, like, to me, there's a lot of value in being able to tell your story and telling the thread that goes through your story so that makes sense for people to digest and understand how those connections happen in a way that is clear. So the marketing aspect of it, a lot of people in this field are in marketing, like they've learned how to be able to market something that is of value. And so I think what Kuchera is really about is to celebrate the experts and all the different multidisciplinary, multicultural talent that is out there, and our allies as well, because we can't do anything without our allyship and our support, and to really get that to the next level and to build partnerships. So we are looking for partnerships and ways to white label this software, to bring it into companies and organizations to help them set their goals, and to be able to give a holistic tool for their employees to set their goals professionally and personally, so that they are seen as valued contributors to the company and the impact that they make. And we can celebrate them and give them a voice and a place where they can document all the things that they're doing, so that the employers can also see all the good work that they're doing and where they may need support. And ultimately, that's really the goal, is that we all need support. We all have mental health challenges at some point in our lives, when we have health setbacks or we have any kind of challenges. All of us are human and we need support around that. So having a place where you can go and find a clinical psychologist, and you can find an attorney because you have some kind of legal question that you need in a crisis. So you may need second opinion about a health from a medical doctor, or you may need a tax accountant to help you better understand what's happening in your business. So the experts that are on there are people that you may never have thought about, that you can access, just like Uber. Before Uber, we didn't all think we needed a personal driver, right? And now we all use it and it's ubiquitous. So Kuchera is giving you access to incredible minds and incredible hearts that normally you wouldn't have access to. And you know, they didn't even think that you can ask a question and be able to learn, and they can share their knowledge asynchronously as well and leave something into perpetuity instead of, or in addition to writing a book, their yeah. knowledge be also kept on our learning management system so people can also see the questions and answers that people have asked in the past. So we're excited to be able to launch this new AI component with adaptive assessment to make sure people are learning the objectives of the courses that are on there, as well as being able to match people with the right coaches and any services you may need. We're here to find the right person for you and research it for you and find you the person that you need. If we don't have them on our platform, we'll go and seek them out and find them for you. So that's the ultimate goal, is when you have a crisis in a situation where you don't know where to go, Coachera is the one-stop shop you can go to find different professionals to help you through navigate all the different stages in your life.
Yeah. Wow. So little sixth grader Vita went from the earliest entrepreneurial initiative that you had back then without a license. You were shut down. And now you truly have a license to implement this amazing tool and coaching system, a really all-encompassive coaching system that backed up by your knowledge and experience and a tremendous team, which is so cool. So amazing. That journey from that first business of yours to this.
Yes. It's pretty inspiring also to be able to, and the privilege for me to be able to be in a position where I can connect the dots for people, where we didn't have any network, we didn't have any connections when we came to the United States. And now we have a global connection to people who are best in class and are experts and that have their heart and their mind and aligned that they want to help support and teach others. And so they can also leave a legacy. So it's an incredible community of like-minded people. So if there are experts that are listening and they want to share their knowledge, and you can monetize it or you can donate it to a nonprofit if you don't want to take on any more financial kind of obligations, or then you can donate that your hourly rate to a nonprofit, or you can do things for free if you want to do mentorship or consulting or coaching. A lot of people are like, well, I'm not a coach. And you don't have to be a certified coach. You can share your knowledge as a consultant or a mentor.
Wow. Fantastic. I also have to say, I love your name, Dr. Beta Sarah Haynes. I think it's so cool. It sounds like Wendy Rhodes, the same syllables. Before we finish up, I was wondering if you could perhaps share some of your values. What is most important to you? What are those guiding values and why?
Yeah. Thank you for that. I think the first one is pretty clear in terms of impact. Being able to have measurable impact is important. I know in my life, I've impacted lives already in my work and saved some people that were suicidal. And so I think everything else is icing on the cake of kind of work I'm doing now. But it's also important work to keep the legacy alive. And then I think the continuous growth is really a big important value for me. It's continual growth. You hear people say, you've changed in a relationship. For example, I've been married 25 years. And when I hear that, I'm like, yeah, I have changed. And my husband thought I would be a research professor and have my summers off and months off here. And then all of a sudden I'm in the startup world going all over the world and not as expected. But I think the ideally is that we're all continuously changing for good. And we all have goals inside of us that we want to continue to pursue. So that's important to me. It's not being stagnant. And then integrity and having aligned values and behaving accordingly. I'm not perfect and I've made mistakes as a parent, as a wife, as a sister and daughter. But I think I've had more good days than bad in terms of making sure that I'm living by my values. And if I'm not, to be able to realign that. And then that's three of them. And then the fourth one is really about peace. Having peace of mind is so important to me. Be able to put my head down on the pillow at night. I sleep very well, knowing that I've lived by my values. That's important. And then I would say with that also, stability is important. Even though I've moved 17 times in 25 years of marriage, I count it. Stability is consistent. Our home is where our furniture is, like where we're, our family is, right? It's not necessarily the vessel where we live. It's really about where my family is and my chosen family. I don't let go of good people. So I have a trail of people I've met throughout on my moves, they hold on to. And relationships, I think, are really important to me. And I'm really privileged at this stage and decade in my life to meet new people that I really adore and love and cherish. So you don't think you can meet people that, you know, throughout your career and your life that you really enjoy. So it's really a blessing to know so many good people. Long-term relationships are really important to me. And that's how I see the world, is through a long-term lens, not just transactional, but finding win-wins and how I can help support others who have supported me and vice versa. So those are my values, and I'm continuously growing as well. And so hopefully in 5 years, if you ask me that, there'll be something else that is a priority at that stage of my life. But right now, leaving a legacy is important to me, and giving back and giving value to society.
That's beautiful. That's really beautiful and so dynamic, not static. I've been really looking forward to this interview, and I'm so impressed. Like I said, you're one of my new heroes. I've been checking out your work, and I'm really impressed by how you're translating everything you can and your understanding of really deep psychological, cultural communities, and psychological aspects and communal aspects of human nature and interaction into something so specific and at the same time so transferable.
Thank you for seeing me. It's hard when you're in the grind and doing the things every day and getting things done. So thank you for that acknowledgement. I value that, and it's important. We all need to have feedback on that you're on the right course. So I appreciate you, and you're so dynamic, and it's rare to find someone that has done so many incredible things under one incredible dome of your incredible mind and heart. So thank you for making this platform so that we can share our stories. So thank you for all your hard work, and we've been waiting for the right moment. And I'm so happy.
I'm so grateful that you exist. Now, also grateful that Wendy exists in the real world, and actually you're so much more than that. That's not a good enough archetype of what you're
maybe we'll
about.
That. We need to thank for connecting us, I guess, also.
Yes, Nicole connected us. Nicole, the member. Thank you, Nicole. So grateful. And I think that is also something that you treasure more and more in what you said at the end there, just relationships, how this one life is a continuation of meetings between human beings. And sometimes those relationships develop really abruptly and surprisingly, and it's so beautiful and taken care of when you're meeting people that are bringing you into their orbit, or you're bringing them into your orbit, and like the energies of meeting, but then out of those energies, when they're combined, new energy emerges, and that translates to a next relationship and meeting. And I love when people embrace that emergence of meetings from initial meetings. So
you said it much more eloquently, but one of the sayings I say in my coaching is dance with the people that invited you to the party, meaning don't forget to spend time and celebrate the people that connected you within the situation. Nicole, to thank them for bringing incredible experiences and people in our lives, and not forgetting those people. That's really important to relationship. The art of relationships is really, really something that is important for hopefully the next generation. And to note as well that transactional relationships are very surface level and not going to be as fruitful as those who are able to maintain relationships and continue to acknowledge the people that have helped support you and your success. I wouldn't be here if I didn't have my mentors and allies supporting me and my parents and sisters and chosen sisters and all the experts that believe in me on Kachera. So I can't do half the things that I've done without that support. So I wanted to acknowledge all those people that have supported me throughout the years.
Your supporters and vice versa, probably.
Yeah.
Vita, I'm really, really grateful. And I'm so proud of myself for not making this into a personal coaching session, which I...
Oh, well, we'll continue at any time.
Yeah, I was trying to hold back. Like, let me tell you about this experience because you're so knowledgeable and you catch the ball immediately. But thank you so much.
Anytime, if you need a sounding board or someone to just listen to or try to solve together or collaborate, I'm here for it. So...
Love that. Would love that.
You can do on-the-spot coaching. Bring all your issues. Bring
all the problems. Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Take care. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Following this interview, I sat down and defined my core values immediately. Dr. Haynes highlighted the significance of measurable impact, continuous growth, integrity, and peace of mind. And I'm so grateful for people like her that are committed to realizing human growth and impact as an integrative process. Thank you for listening to the Chameleons Podcast. I'm your host, Imak Samrana.